But our grandmothers were both seamstresses for a reason.
KBOO Radio. Close encounters of the community kind.
Did you ever do to make them feel this way? Joseph, what do they see in you? What do they fear in you? To want to put you away. Joseph, where are you gonna go? Your people want to know what will become of them. Joseph, why won't they let you live? What more can you give? They want it all to end. And as the sun goes down behind the hill, you feel the chill of winter coming. And in the cold and hungry
my name is Paul Rowland. This has been, for several months, the Wisdom of the Elders series made by some local Portland Native radio producers. But today we're bringing you a special program on the Megalodes issue and Native resistance to it. And we'll be having a number of guests from the Umatilla Tribe, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, as it's formally known. But they are from the Walla Walla Tribe, which is one of the Confederated Tribes. I myself am not Native American, but I am trying my best to present their voice. And I would like to read, before we get started, something from our PM News and Public Affairs Director, Jenka Soderberg, that we are looking for hosts to continue Native American programming on KBOO. For regular listeners, you also know that this was before Tillicum Wawa, and the hosts, for various time pressures and personal commitments, were unable to continue. And we are looking, they have stepped down as of, it's been since June 6th that we've been running Wisdom of the Elders. We would like to continue to have a program of, by, and for the Native American community on KBOO. So if you have any ideas for potential hosts or want to help make phone calls to recruit new programmers, or if you yourself are Native American and want to get involved, please contact KBOO's Evening News and Public Affairs Director, Jenka Soderberg, as soon as possible. And that telephone number is 503-231-8032, extension 203, or newsdirector@kboo.org. That's newsdirector, all together, at kboo.org. And we really would like to find some people to, could be a collective, lots of different possibilities. So step up and make your voice heard. And without further ado, I would like to welcome our guests. Hello, are you all there?
Yeah, this is Kathy Sampson Cruzy, the Umatilla Indian Reservation, the home of my father, Carl Sampson.
Hello, and you have your two sisters, I believe, with you?
Yes, Sandy Sampson, X775.
And I am Linda Sampson.
We have another elder with us?
Art McConville.
Hello. Hello to all of you. And we also will have a guest with a rising tide who is just outside our door and can walk in at any moment if he likes. And we are going to talk. I just have a really brief introduction. I mean, people have been hearing about these megalodes for quite a while. But if you all will bear with me for a second, just for those who may not be so aware, there was an article called What is a Megalode? It was an article by Richard Reed in the Oregonian's online journal, Oregon Live, December 24th, which is a decent resource. A megalode is defined as a truckload so gigantic that when hauled by a rig and trailer, it takes up both lanes of a two-lane highway and can't fit under a freeway bridge. The term was apparently coined by Idaho activist Borg Hendrickson in 2010 when she and her husband started a website called Fighting Goliath. Now, there's been, these megalodes have been going on. As you know, there's many different types of megalodes, but these particular megalodes used for going up to Alberta, Canada, have been going for a couple years, I believe at least, at various intervals of months. And these particular pieces of equipment are giant evaporators. They're designed to assist in the process of injecting steam underground to melt the bitumen, which, if you were listening to my piece at the end of the news, is a substance that is in the tar sands, it is the tar sands really, which is then refined into crude oil using large quantities of water. And as Barbara Bernstein pointed out in her show this past Monday, is then diluted with condensates, another petroleum product that has to be shipped or piped in from elsewhere just to allow that, the bitumen that's been heated and melted to pass through the pipelines, which has been such a controversy with the KXL pipeline, the Northern Gateway, and other pipelines, including the West to East that our guest talked about just a few minutes ago. Now, in September, a federal judge in Idaho ruled in favor of the Nez Perce tribe and Idaho Rivers United, blocking further megalode transports on Scenic Highway US 12 until the Forest Service could complete a corridor study and tribal consultation. So in the meantime, Omega Morgan must take a longer and more circuitous route through eastern Oregon and southern Idaho and Montana to get them to Alberta, which brings us to our guests out there in eastern Oregon who are now facing the transport through their traditional territory because of all these developments. And I would also like to welcome Stephen from Rising Tide, who just walked into our studio. Hi, Stephen.
Hi.
And he'll have something to talk about in action that was carried out this morning here in Portland. So I was hoping maybe one of you could perhaps just say a few words or give a greeting in your language. Do we lose them?
So you want to say, how about we all teach you something tonight? And it says, so we'll say good night.
Okay.
Good evening. Well, that's better. Say good evening. And we'll say, Shiech Kolawit. Inish Wanesho Lawiyah, which means that's my name in Indian, which is, I don't have a translation for it, but we have protocol how we would introduce ourselves, but it would take me forever to actually enunciate everything for you. So tonight we'll teach you just to say good evening, and that's Shiech Kolawit.
Okay. I won't attempt that right now. I might embarrass myself. But thank you for that.
And it's similar to like what we have in with our basketball team, because our charter school is called Nich Yahweh. And so we've got all kinds of crazy names across the state of Oregon for us. It's Mickey or Nicky Al Yahweh and all kinds of crazy things. So you can see how it would take us quite some time to get into some linguistics. So, but we are from Nich Yahweh, and tonight's word is Shiech Kolawit.
Okay, thank you for that. So I was hoping to sort of just set the background. The issue here specifically, one of the issues, there are obviously many issues, is the whole issue of consultation, which consultation over the shipment of these megalodes through your traditional ceded territories, C-E-D-E-D. To understand what ceded means, one has to understand something about the treaties and your history. So maybe you could just enlighten us, just talk a little bit about that first.
Okay, so we'll start about the treaty.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dad.
That's, in a way, it's kind of funny because one of the people that were writing an article didn't know how to spell seeded. They spelled it S-E-E-D-E-D, seeded. So
It's not the GMO seed in it.
Yeah. But when we did seed the land, it was 6.4 million acres that was stolen or taken away from my people in the Walla Walla Valley. And the negotiators at that time were Palmer, Governors Palmer and Stevens. And they wanted to, when they were talking and negotiating, they wanted to put us on either the Yakima or the Nez Perce reservations that were established already. But our leaders at that time said, no, we want to stay right where the bones and the blood and the ashes of our people are. And that was the Umatilla Reservation. When they were negotiating that treaty, those two governors threatened our leaders at that time. They told them, if you don't sign this treaty, your people will walk knee-deep in blood. And that's how it went that time after that. And they eventually signed it. Some of them were very reluctant in doing it. Right after they signed that treaty with my relative, it was my great-great-grandfather, Pia Moxmox. They murdered him just a few miles on the other side of Walla Walla on a ranch called the Bergevin Ranch. And there were about 40 just volunteer soldiers, they called themselves. They weren't regular, huh? Oregon militia. Yeah, well, all the same to me. Oregon militia, whatever. But they were still nothing but a bunch of lynchers. There was one young Nez Perce and about 10 to 15 of Pia Moxmox's warriors that was captured there at that Bergevin Ranch. And when they did it, they tied them up so they wouldn't get away. But Pia Moxmox tried to loosen himself from those ropes, and they killed him. They shot him right there on the site. When they did this, they cut off his ears and put them in whiskey, a preservative. They cut off both of his hands. They chopped off his feet. And they cut strips off his back to make souvenir razor straps for those volunteers. And also they scalped his hair, his head. When they did that, they made buttons out of his skull. And after this, they took those ears and put them on display in the state capitol in Salem. They stayed there for years until that part burned up. But this is the way my people were treated then, and it's coming into now. And some of the things, same things that happened then are happening again. They also, when they had the so-called massacre of the Whitmans in Walla Walla, went looking for our Cayuse people to bring them to justice, supposedly. And they did. There were five of them that they brought to Oregon City to hang. And only one of those warriors was guilty.
You're fading in and out a little bit.
What's that?
Your voice is fading in and out a little bit. I'm not sure what the problem is.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
I'm on right on top of the machine. But that's some of the things, the events that led up to our people being put on this 150,000-acre reservation that is still the homeland of our people. And will be, as long as we can protect it from things like the megaloads, nuclear waste, things that are causing our salmon to die. I was told a long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, by an elder that knew the Columbia River really well. He fished it all his life, sturgeon, chinook, shad, everything. He said, watch that river, take care of it, because there are all kinds of harmful things coming down. And sure enough, he was right. Percy Brigham was his name. He was a well-known fisherman in this part of the country.
So this is a
just a minute. I'm learning.
Art, did you want to add?
So I just want to while you're deciding who's going to talk next, I just want to say this is a history that a lot of people would rather forget, I imagine, and perhaps don't like to be reminded of. But as you said, you know it's very, very present to you, obviously, because you have this, you know, you're still in the place where you're from because of the sacrifices made by, you know, your ancestors, and so you can't forget. And so it's helpful to all of us, I feel, to know this history. Many of us are not from here and don't have that kind of connection.
So I think it helps us in establish the kind of different kind of connection to the land. Just want to say that. So, Art, you wanted to talk some about this?
Yeah. My point of view, I guess, is a concern for the land in the sense that, you know, we've always been a part of the land. The land has always been a part of us. And that's something I know that ever since, you know, for the last 500 years, I guess, there's always been a total disrespect for the land by people besides ourselves. You know, no one seems to take any interest in the fact that that the land, the earth itself, is very alive. And everything that grows upon it, everything that flows across it, has a spirit of its own. And these have, you know, these beliefs and understandings, you know, it probably spread out across the United States with the Native people. And we're always concerned every time anything happens, you know, that affects our traditional foods, you know, the natural environment itself, the waters, the air, anything that grows on the earth, anything that lives on the earth, the birds, just everything, every kind of life out there on earth. You know, there are our neighbors, there are friends, there are brother and sisters. You know, we're all together in the same situation, except, you know, they aren't able to defend themselves against all of this intrusion, all of this contamination that's going on in this world. You know, we're only a part of this end of the country, but we know that this kind of thing is going on all over the United States, where, you know, the earth is just totally, you know, being drowned in oil and contamination and, you know, nuclear waste and just everything. You know, I see pictures of people lighting water in their homes, in the bathtub, lighting it on fire. You know, in their kitchen sink, they light it on fire because of the natural gas mining and use throughout the areas. And our way of looking at things, I guess, is, you know, my elders that taught me, you know, they was confronted one time by an additional natural gas pipeline going through their territory that ran parallel to the existing one. And the contractors were trying to say, well, as we put this pipeline in, we're going to replace everything just as it was before. And the elders told them, well, you do what you want because we're not going to be able to use it. And the reason was because once man has touched it or moved it or changed it, and it's no good to us anymore spiritually or traditionally, we can't use it for ceremonies because it's been touched by man. Because to us, and what they told me is that the best, the finest medicine, what we call, you know, everything that has life, that helps us have life, you know, so everything that's even looked upon by mankind has been contaminated. So our mere presence, even if we're a good people, you know, even if we're really take good care of everything, even that has a slight contamination thing on it. So when we're dealing with people that have no understanding, no caring about anything, no feelings, remorse about what they're doing to the land or the people, you know, that's poison upon the air every time they walk through it, poison upon the earth. You know, just their thoughts, just their being, everything like that contaminates, you know, to some degree. And then everything that they're doing now on a larger scale, on the corporate scale, you know, we see pictures of the damage that the earth has, you know, taken, you know, just totally destroyed, unusable probably for hundreds or thousands of years. You know, the people that live there, they don't have water. They don't have anything that's any good anymore. Cancer rates are going up. You know, everything is going on, and it's a really bad situation as far as we can tell. And I know that some of those corporate people are just trying to push it off, you know, like we're just, you know, we're just blowing wind at them or something, you know, like it's not really that bad, and, you know, and they're just trying to make a little bit of deal out of it, and a lot of people believe that. A lot of people don't understand this, you know, and I'm glad that, you know, on your end over there, that you're willing to listen and willing to try to understand where we're coming from, what we believe, and why we believe that. Because it's all very strong, it's all very purposeful to us that we stand up for everything, especially ourselves, our people, our children, our grandchildren, and on, you know. And, you know, I don't want to see my grandchildren have to deal with these things, you know. And I'm sure you don't want, you know, your children over there having to deal with it, even though there's many things going on in the Portland metro area, too, that are very harmful to the population there.
Yeah.
And
so I just realized that I neglected to say that the earlier speaker, Carl Sampson, who I hadn't fully introduced, is the traditional chief of the Walla Walla tribe. And I was just hoping one of you could just sort of quickly explain that before we, because we need to get into the Megalodes issue itself in the half hour or so we have left. The idea of the confederated tribes, and we also do need to talk more specifically about the treaty rights and how that relates to the consultation issue. But talk about the confederated tribes of the Umatilla. How many different bands and tribes are there? So people can just have an understanding what that means.
There are four head men besides myself. There are three others, and we're all related in a way. There's Bill Burke, Gary Burke, Jesse Jones, and myself. And I was given the name of Pia Mox Mox when I was living in Chicago back in 1962. My aunt and my mother all decided it was time for me to take a different name. I had another Indian name, Witsimatash. And so they had a ceremony, big ceremony in order to do this. They had to give away a lot of things, blankets, goods, whatever, to stand me up with that person. But they didn't totally go through with the whole thing. 1990 is when my other aunts, Edith McLeod and Cecilia Bertram, decided it was time for me to step in to the moccasins of that great leader. And so they finished it with another ceremony. And when my aunt was talking to me, she said, when you take on this new name, you must have seven skins thick in order to carry on and be a good leader. Now I know what she means after all these years. It's been quite a chore to do this, but it'll be handed down when I leave this earth. it'll be carried on by some of my grandchildren or my son. So it's one of those things that just keeps going on and on with this great leader that I told you about that got massacred or got murdered in the Walla Walla Valley.
So,
yeah.
So this, the traditional leadership is obviously different from what is the current governance structure, which it derives again from the treaty and from the I guess the Indian Reorganization Act, perhaps, or there's different. I know there's different statuses, but it's a different thing. Maybe you could just briefly explain a little bit about, because I know there's an executive board, or how does it work with the Umatilla?
Yeah, there's what they call it. We call a BOT, the Board of Trustees.
Uh-huh. Because some have a tribal council. There's different.
Yeah, we have a council also that makes up all of the tribal members, 18 years and older, that are enrolled, and they make up the council. But a lot of that power has been diluted over the years. It's really not that the way it used to be when I was younger. We had some real powerful women then that voiced their opinions at council.
Mm-hmm. So I know we have to sort of unfortunately fit a lot of your history and a lot of your perspectives into this artificial framework of an hour-long radio show. I apologize for that, but that's, as you know, that's the way it is. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here. My name's Paul Rowland. This is a program, as I said at the outset, that has ordinarily been airing the Wisdom of the Elders series, a very wonderful program produced by some people who are also local here in Portland, and is going to continue running until we can find someone who actually wants to step up and host a Native American program in this time slot. And anyone who thinks they can do that, is interested, hey, we'll help you. We will give you all the training you need, all the support. But we just need some people to step up and do that. And so we're talking about the Megalodes. We're talking to a number of people from the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla out in eastern Oregon. Members of the Sampson family and Art McConville, including Carl Sampson, who you just heard, who is the traditional chief of the Walla Walla. And so I do want to bring Stephen in because there is another demonstration. There's been quite a few demonstrations. We want to talk about how environmentalists and other non-Indians and Native Americans, including Umatillas, Nez Perce, and other tribes of the Columbia River, and also the Shoshone Bannock out in Idaho recently weighed in and asked for consultation on the Megalodes because it's now passing also through their traditional territory. It's a complicated issue. We've been covering it a lot here on KBOO. So I talked about the ceded lands that based upon the ceded lands in the whole process of the the Euro-American settlers coming in and with the armies and forcing these treaties, forcing the Native people to give up millions of acres. And what was remained was the reservation. You reserved the right to that land, but he also reserved certain rights to hunt, fish, and gather on these ceded lands, which is what set the stage for this whole issue of consultation, in which a judge in Idaho actually ruled in favor of the Wild Idaho United, I believe. Idaho Rivers United and the Nez Perce, saying that consultation hadn't happened and the foresters needed to go back. And that is all, that whole idea of consultation is a new concept. It's not in the treaty itself, but it's based upon court rulings, a whole judicial set of precedents that require, because the tribes have a government-to-government relationship with the federal government, and the treaty protects these certain rights to these usual and accustomed practices, that there has to be consultation for any federal activity that is going to potentially impact. And so I just want to lay that groundwork. So this megalode, these megalodes, which are passing through traditional territory, there was no consultation of by the Oregon Department of Transportation. And so Umatilla wrote a letter Sorry, I feel I need to just sort of condense this so then we can get into the meat of the matter and some of your perspectives on all this. And the Oregon Department of Transportation did not consult with Nez Perce, and so the megaload cannot go through there until that happens. And now you're saying the same thing. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what's going on within the Umatilla tribe and some of your concerns and some of the things you've been doing about that.
Linda, there you go. So a couple of the things that we see on this end is what you said, government, and those are things that are written off with an ordinance from the tribe and to the state that said, you know, let's always meet and have a good, nice, open relationship and let everybody know this is what we're going to do, and you can look up the statutes and, you know, there's executive orders on it. And the key thing is that we are looking at the same thing as most tribes, is that this was an ODOT, Oregon Department of Transportation. They are the ones that issue the permit. They're the ones at any point in time, you know, because they're overweight, and you can guess that 900,000 pounds going through some steep country is the size of a football field, is definitely an oversized load. So when you're looking at those issues, those are the things that are just about with everybody out there, with, like you just said, the Shoshones, the Nez Perce, there's going to be the Warm Springs, or any tribe within the Pacific Northwest Corridor, that these things are coming through our country, and the end product is going to end up being exported back out to our country. So there's a lot of pros and cons about why is it, you know, you've got, you know, people in different parts of our country that definitely have it. But when we look at some of the basic things that we see as tribal members, and not as our tribe, but as tribal members, is that you're right, it's going through, but we're also changing the game every minute. The state of the Oregon can say, well, we're going to go through the daytime or the weather. And right now it's taking them forever to come through the megaload. So the government-to-government consultation, again, going back to what is our tribe doing, we presented it to them. They are fully aware of it. They've got just as much information going on. They're meeting with the governor next week in what we call government-to-government relations. So these are the issues that we brought up to our tribal council, or to our board, and in council, and just to make sure everybody's aware. And I think that anybody that's looking at megaloads knows there's an end product going to be exported back out, and it's going to go through our waterways, and it's going to go through some very pristine country. And anybody that lives in our country knows that you live out here for a reason, and that's so that you can go out and see some elk and deer. And for us as natives, we gather a lot of those things in just about all countries because of this 6.94. Our biggest problem is that we are on a reservation, and when we did that, we still have to go out past our reservation boundary lines to gather some of these things. They don't all live right here. So I see that going on right now. I think that we'll wait and see what the tribe's going to, you know, where they're at. And in the meantime, we're going to, you know, just keep wondering why you're coming. So
who is this speaking?
This is, my name's Linda.
Okay. Sorry. There's several of you. I just want to keep it straight. So.
Yeah. And we are definitely all different. Each one of us have a different opinion about how we see things are going on. And I look at it as it's a billion-dollar business, and I just don't see it being economically sound practice to sit here and wait for these loads, because now the third one's still sitting at the port of Umatilla, snowing in our mountains right now, and common sense tells you not the smartest place to come. So,
well, obviously they feel a pressure. Obviously they have to fulfill a contract for one thing. So they're under a lot of pressure. So, but yep. you one thing I want to get back to, you mentioned, which was who's going to be meeting next week with the governor?
Our tribal board of trustees. They meet with the governor and their departments, and they'll go down and have a discussion. So on the 17th is what our BOT, our board of trustees chairman, told us today.
Okay.
So, you know, you're going to leave it with them, you know, because, you know, this is America. You can have freedom of speech. Whether or not, you know, you agree with what their decisions are versus what mine are is the beautiful part about it. And especially in our family, we all agree to disagree. So we're going to just have to, you know, wait for what they're going to tell us, because they had written their letters in November, you know, to the governor. Nobody told me today whether or not the governor had responded. So maybe next week you know, they will have a better conclusion. AT&I is coming up. Gives the tribes, not the affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians, gives them a chance to sit down amongst each other and make some decisions as to what we are going to do with the Pacific Corridor, because the tar sands, the Bakken's, the Wyoming coal, all these things are looking for a west port, you know, a west coast port, and that's one thing that's going to end up, whether or not eventually they got railroads, we have gas lines, we have major interstates, and a few of those are right through the reservation, but they are also within the ceded. And the biggest thing that most people don't realize is all the ceded boundaries from the tribes that are next to us, to the north of us are the Yakimas, to the east of us are the Nez Perce, to the south of us are the Paiute, and to the west are the Warm Springs. So, you know, I pray, and that's the main thing that we have been doing. So when we do meet people with Rising Tide, is for us it's always to be in prayer. And so that's what I think you understood from Art, is that we aren't, you know, we're not, we're in prayer constantly that we can make some kind of a change in a peaceful manner, that we pray upon all of us, even the people we know, the people that are doing their jobs, that are there, they're doing, that's their job, that's a contract, that's, you know, not be, you know, naive about what the business world is doing, but you got to pray that they're going to be safe, because if you've never traveled through Eastern Oregon, the country they're going through is pretty treacherous for these monster football field things coming through.
So I would like to, thank you, I'd like to bring Stephen into this, because you just mentioned Rising Tide, and I just there's this article that just came out in Yes Magazine, so I'd like to cite a number of resources. That the headline is Movement to Resist Tar Sands Megaloads Brings Together Northwest Tribal Members and Environmentalists, and this I think is a positive thing, and I know that Rising Tide has been taking great care to try to understand the position of the Native Americans and the protocols and negotiate all these relationships. So, Stephen, maybe you could just give us an update on what's going on with the ODOT and anything else you want to add to the conversation at this point.
Sure. So, yeah, as you know, ODOT issued permits without really seeking consultation from the Umatilla, which is actually violating an executive order from Governor Kitzhaber himself, who says a lot that he really cares about, you know, indigenous rights, and goes to conferences and talks about it, as well as claiming that he cares a lot about the environment. So ODOT just basically is in the business of issuing permits. Anything that's asked for, they permit. Same as at the Department of Environmental Quality or EPA water pollution permits or air pollution permits. You know, the business of our government for a very long time is, as I believe Art was saying, is just total wanton destruction of the environment without any hesitation or, you know, they can't even imagine a basis for saying no to these things. So, you know, we've, as Rising Tide, gone to ODOT and requested meetings so that we could explain that, you know, the tribe whose lands they're moving through actually don't want this, and that it's illegal to do that if they don't ask them permission. And also let them know the public is really opposed, that we don't want million-pound loads that ultimately are destroying our atmosphere and, you know, water to be moving over roads that were not designed to carry them. Particularly public roads, which we pay for, that we don't want to be carrying these things. And in my conversations with ODOT, this guy, Tom Strandberg, I believe he's from Region 5, said to me, well, you know, we can't approve everything, or we can't have the public approve everything that moves on public highways. As if, you know, this was like a self-evident statement that public resources shouldn't actually serve the public in some way. You know, they just see it as a, you know, move something from A to B kind of a situation. And we stumbled upon these minutes of a meeting that their ODOT permitting division actually had with Omega Morgan and some other companies back in November. And it's very interesting to read, because it just kind of verifies what I've just been describing, that ODOT has no interest in denying permits and can't even imagine a basis for denying them. At one point, this ODOT employee, Greg is his name, asked industry members what they considered a reasonable basis to say no to a permit. When is a load so large or the permit requirements to move cars around it safely so onerous that the resulting inconvenience to users of a highway should direct a decision to deny a permit? And what does that look like? And that question was just completely ignored. There's not even an answer recorded in the minutes. And the fact that someone from ODOT is asking industry members that question is a total embarrassment. It shows that he looks to industry to do his job or to do his own PR about why he's making certain decisions. And it's important to remember that historically these agencies were created to really buffer public opinion against what corporations were doing. They were not the result of a populist outcry that the government get things under control. The public normally is pretty good at just going and blocking things they don't like, or they go and confront that corporation. What these agencies do is they get in the way and they say, no, we work for you, so, get into this bureaucratic labyrinth and run the gauntlet, and, a year later, you're going to be exhausted and you'll have no money and we'll have won. So, it's important to remember when you deal with these agencies that they're not acting in good faith.
I guess that's an old story that our native friends
totally
unfortunately know all too well.
Oh yeah, I don't have to. Yeah, they don't need to hear it from me.
So you were at the Governor Hotel this morning, where Kitz Haber had his power breakfast. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that. This has been a campaign that's been ongoing for a number of months now. There's a kind of a Megalodes working group that's connected to Rising Tide. Rising Tide's been working on a wide variety of fronts, as we were talking about. There's coal trains, there's liquefied natural gas pipelines. There's a lot of stuff going on now. This Megalode thing is a big issue because they're on the road, and so a campaign tries to reach wherever these decision makers are, at whatever point you can gain some traction. So Kitz Haber obviously is now in consultation with the tribes. He's the one who has final say over this whole issue of the Megalodes as, governor of the state of Oregon. So what happened at the breakfast this morning?
Well, I went to this power breakfast listened to sat amongst many powerful people wearing very powerful suits and listened to a power speech by our governor. And I looked down at one point during the breakfast and I found oil in my food and I'd actually eaten some of it. So I was a little upset. I kind of shouted about it and, naturally just started thinking about oil spills and oil trains and all the fossil fuel movements and exports getting proposed here. And started thinking out loud about how Kitz Haber called a special session of the legislature so that Nike could get a tax deal. And yet he's not doing that about, the climate crisis, even though it really warrants it. I think that's actually a real issue of public concern that I think actually has paralyzed a lot of people just in how terrifying it is. And rather than dealing with that, he's going to marshal the full force of our government. Call people in when they're not even in session. Tell them, leave your home, come to the Capitol, because we need to talk about the tax deal that Nike's getting, who, by the way, uses slave labor. So I called him out for that and told him that if he was actually a leader, he'd be dealing with it. And of course, he's not. And unfortunately, I didn't get around to talking about the Megalodes because security came over and, marshaled me out of the room. But I think I made my point.
And meanwhile, there's a lot of people outside leafleting and trying to engage with the people who afterwards left the room and talking to the media. And again, this is part of, a campaign is something that sort of you that develops as you go. You sort of try to invent it as you go along. So now the Megalodes issue is a big issue. The Oregonian is writing about it finally. That's what happens if you, cause enough stir. And now, there's some movement happening, some interesting relationships, collaborations, alliances developing. Before we wrap up with our friends out in Umatilla, maybe just talk a little bit about Rising Tide, how people can get involved, what some of the next steps might be.
Well, Rising Tide has a lot of open meetings. So if you go to portlandrisingtide.org, you can see a schedule. You can see, an orientation meeting that's coming up that you can plug into. Our position is that, we're not going to solve the climate crisis using the same thinking that got us into it. We're not going to use business logic and, you know, we're not going to just magically create sustainable businesses that, you know, create a collaborative win-win the way people talk about at Power Breakfast. The only way to do it is by really critically examining what brought us to this place. And I think that a big piece of that is showing solidarity with indigenous people and helping them to assert sovereignty and treaty rights to actually stop these giant loads from moving across their land, or to stop tar sands extraction from happening without their permission, because you know, they have a right to say no to that. And the kind of desecration that's occurred to the land and the environment, it's fundamentally about a lack of respect and a lack of consent. And it was always someone who actually understands that things should not be done, but those people aren't listened to. So, you know, in order to invert the power dynamics that have brought us to this place, we have to actually stand with those people. You have to be able to draw a line and say, you will not do this here, and then actually spread that. So I think that certainly with tar sands, we know it's one of the most, it's the most destructive industrial project in the world right now. And that means it's also the most destructive in the history of the world, because things have gotten worse over time. So the only way to stop that is by supporting the indigenous folks. So, you know, that's what we're talking about, and that's what we're doing.
Thank you, Stephen.
And may I add, this is Kathy Sampson Cruzy. Back in November of 2013, the National Congress of American Indians and other Native organizations met with the Obama administration to address the effects of climate change in Indian country. They went to the White House and had quite a big conference with the Secretary of the Interior, Sally Jewell, a lot of government officials, including President Obama. And Secretary Jewell told our people, National Congress of American Indians, regionally, it's affiliated tribes of Northwest Indians, and of course, all of our tribes here in the Northwest. She quotes by saying, of the ongoing dialogues we need to have as we work together toward tribal self-determination and self-governance and promoting prosperous and resilient tribal nations. The Secretary of Energy also spoke, including we have friends when we were in Alaska, Mike Williams of Akiak. They discussed the 30 Alaska Native villages that are facing imminent threats from rising sea levels. Now hydroelectric and other energy projects have stymied by climate change. The EPA administrator, Ms. McCarthy, talked about, you know, more intergovernmental communications. President Obama himself, this is a quote off of the NCAI.org website, the health of tribal nations depends on the health of tribal land. So it falls on all of us to protect the extraordinary beauty of those lands for future generations. And already, many of your lands have felt the impact of climate change, including more extreme flooding and droughts. That's why, as part of the Climate Action Plan, I announced this year my administration is partnering with you to identify where your lands are vulnerable to climate change and how we can make them more resilient. He did an executive order. So when we look at these, and when we as common people, common tribal members, we're not elected officials per se, we're mothers, grandmothers, social workers, teachers, healthcare professionals, we entrust our experts, our bodies of archaeologists and biologists and the like, our attorneys, to fight that good fight. But when we had been following the issues of the megaloads and what was happening up in Nimiipuu country, it was just like batting an eye, and all of a sudden they were here. It was going to happen. And one of our dear friends that we met that came over when we were praying here when the load was at Pendleton, I want to read her quote because it was pretty powerful, Alexandria Monte. She says, why would people pray, sing, get arrested, stand in the freezing cold at night and try to stop megaloads of oil refinery equipment on their way to Alberta, Canada, tar sands? Or protest the Keystone XL pipeline, coal and oil export terminals. So we asked ourselves, what is more important, which was always told to us by our elders, and our parents, Carl and Arlita Sampson, have always said with a strong conviction and told us, we must stand up for the seven generations to come. And we truly feel that it's our moral, cultural, ethical obligation to do that now.
The megalodes, you know, in and of themselves, I just want to cite this article that I came across in the Argus Observer, which is a small town paper from out in eastern Oregon, where there are serious concerns being raised from a local community about the number of these megalodes, the damage to the roads, and obviously these companies like Omega Morgan, which is hauling these huge oversized loads, aren't going to pay for maintenance. Obviously, there's going to have to be maintenance, just the sheer weight of these things. And just the number of the potential for more and more. They cited that there's another corporation that's planning on coming in with a number of more, even bigger loads upcoming. And there seems to be no end in sight once an industrial corridor is potentially established that's going to be running through eastern Oregon, Idaho, Montana, up into Alberta. And the issue that Stephen was bringing up, that you're bringing up, the issue that native treaty rights, indigenous treaty rights, and natural rights, if you were, are something that is a really strong, and just the fact that so much of this it takes place either in native indigenous territory, First Nations territory up in Alberta, or through traditional territory here in the Northwest, that indigenous resistance could be key, and also. Like First Nations treaty rights up in Canada are still some of the strongest tools, just as they are down here, as we've seen for salmon protection, many other things, are some, one of the strongest legal tools that we have. So I wanted to ask you what sort of communication do you have? Oh, I lost my point here, but the megalodes is just one part of the equation, as you have repeated yourself, that what is going to potentially come back here in terms of tar sands oil, shale oil, and other things. The other part of the factor of the industrial corridor, that's the other part of the equation, and that leads to where these things are going and what use is being made of them, not just the load in and of itself. So have you had communications with First Nations people from Alberta? Are there any alliances being developed along those lines?
This is Sandy Sampson, I'm sorry.
Hi, Sandy.
Well, there was a gentleman from, he's actually, his tribe is, pardon me? His tribe is from Texas, and he currently lives in Joseph, Oregon, which is up by the Wallawas. He did a documentary in regards to the First Nation people, and when he came, when we were praying, when the second megalode was here in Pendleton, he stated that the First Nation people are, you know, are supportive of what we're doing here, trying to stop the megalod from going through our country and going to theirs, and that they kind of praised us for standing up, whether it's Umatilla tribe, the Nez Perce tribe, but the documentary that he's doing with them was, you know, on the fracking that's happening up there, and that they support us and they do appreciate everything that we're trying to do to stop these evaporators getting into Canada.
What you're doing is being noticed, obviously.
Correct.
So we only have just a few minutes left here. That's just the way radio seems to go. I do want to again reference this article in Yes Magazine that just came out. You can find that online. Just Google Yes Magazine. There's other resources. People can go to the Umatilla Tribe website and find out information about the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla. There's Columbia River Indian Tribal Fish Commission has put out some reports. They did a resolution against the coal trains, and they did issue a statement about the megalodes and tar sands, and they've done some good work on climate change. There's lots of resources out there, Rising Tide, as I mentioned. Just want to ask you for some last words about, you know, where this is going, you know, encouraging our listeners to, you know, to really understand where you're coming from and rethink some of this history.
Just one quick, you know, you were asking about our government-to-government relationship with the state. You know, the bill that was executed in May of 1996, which is Executive Order 9630, and the executive order established a process to assist in resolving potential conflicts, maximizing key intergovernmental relationships, and enhance an exchange of ideas and resources for the greater good of all Oregon citizens. So, you know, when that executive order was done, and the meetings that our tribal leaders are going to throughout the state of Oregon, you know, in 2001 they enacted legislator enacted SB 770, which is ORS 182.162.168, which formalizes the government-to-government relationship. So, you know, this was done on part of all Oregon tribes with the, you know, with the government to establish these relationships, you know, for the good of all, you know, all Oregonians. So, and, you know, hopefully, like we, Linda said, that, you know, this issue will be brought up at the meeting on January 17th. So, and, but, you know, and in February, the week of February 17th through the 20th is the Affiliated Tribes of the Northwest Indians. And that is going to be held on close to the Lummi Reservation, which I'm sure that will be another big issue that will be brought up by 43 tribes of the Northwest.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we have run out of time, and I would like to thank you all very much for speaking with us. I've been speaking with Kathy, Linda, and Sandy Sampson, and their father, Carl Sampson, traditional chief of the Walla Walla tribe of the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla, as well as Art McConville. And I also have been speaking in the studio with Stephen of Rising Tide, Portland Rising Tide. And so once again, thank you all very much for joining us this evening.
All right, thanks.
Okay.
Don't forget the mystery here.
Okay. And you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for Hard Knock Radio.
Everybody, welcome to another edition. It is Hard Knock Radio. Davey D hanging out with you this afternoon. Today, we take a look at the life and times of Amiri Baraka. Our special guest is Ricky Vincent as we talk about the passing of a legend. The father of the Black Arts Movement, Amiri Baraka, passed away this afternoon. We talk about him on Hard Knock Radio.
Good people, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio, a show with music and discussion, addressing socio-political issues relevant to African peoples in this nation. We encourage you to call in with some positive, proactive solutions to what we are facing today. Guess Who's Coming to Radio every second and fourth Thursday at 8 p.m. on KBOO, your community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 2014 Martin Luther King Breakfast on Monday, January 20th at 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast MLK Boulevard in Portland. Each year, the Scanner organizes an inspiring presentation honoring the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and highlights the good work of people making a difference in the community. This year's keynote speaker is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Oregon Health Authority Director. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's Martin Luther King Breakfast on January 20th, 8:30 a.m. at the Oregon Convention Center. More information can be found at kboo.fm/MLKBreakfast2014.
This is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance.
This is Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
This is Mitty Baracco. Whenever I'm in the area, I try to listen to Hard Knock Radio to raise the level of my consciousness. Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
Who will survive America? Few Americans, very few Negroes, and no crackers at all. Who will survive America? Few Americans, very few Negroes, and no crackers at all.
Who will survive America? Very few Negroes.